From NPR and Chicago Public Radio, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Colonel Castle, and here's your host at the Chase Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, everybody. The great philosopher Socrates said the unexamined life is not worth living, and who are we to argue with a guy who could rock a toga like that? So this week we're going to examine some recent visits with celebrity guests.
You might argue that this is really just an excuse to take the week off. We say, well, what do you think Socrates was after? The Athenians sentenced him to death, but at least he didn't have to go into the office.
So, this week, while we're getting ready to travel to Berkeley, California for two shows, next week we're focusing on people who examine our lives and their lives only to make fun of them, namely comedians. We're going to begin with a prime example, comedian Dennis Leary, who joined us here at the theater in December of 2008, along with Mo Rocca, Adam Felber, and Kyrie O'Connor. So why We Suck, a feel-good book for a feel-good time?
Yeah, the subtitle is A Feel-Good Guide to Staying Fat, Loud, Lazy, and Stupid.
Right.
So it's really for all of us.
I think so.
I don't think I left anybody out.
No, but your theory, your book does not seem to imply that any American needs advice on how to do that, though.
Yeah, it's kind of a little trip through. It talks about why we're great and then all the things that we need, I think, a little touch-up on.
Really?
Like skinny jeans are for skinny people. I apparently, that's just lost on most of the population in this country.
Right.
Most of the people that are wearing them look like they jumped out of a 15-story window and landed in the jeans and then never took the jeans off. Meanwhile, the skinny people are wearing the hip-hop baggy jeans with the underwear showing. So all we got to do is really flip that. You know what I mean?
Are you worried that you've become one of those guys like kids these days? What's wrong with them?
Oh, I am that guy.
You're totally that guy.
Oh, yeah. I'm totally that guy. No, that's all over the book. I give that speech all the time.
Yeah.
I don't send my kids to their rooms. There's too much stuff in their rooms. There's plasma televisions, PlayStations. We go to their rooms when they do something wrong. You stay down here where the books are. We're going up there.
Speaking of kids, you actually write about yourself as a kid. You write about your background, which I find interesting. You grew up near Boston.
Yes, in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Worcester.
Love W-U-S-T-A, as we pronounce it.
Here's the thing. I mean, I imagine my experience is that most comedians, anyway, had childhoods. They were shy. They were a little lonely. They found out that being funny could maybe get them some friends. They went that way. That wasn't really your...
Really? You think most comedians are...
Yeah, that's been my experience.
I thought most of us, at some level, were repressed by religious figures in an organized religion.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, every guy I know, Chris Rock, John Stewart, John Stewart was in Hebrew school. I was in Catholic school. It's basically the same idea. Don't laugh at any of this. That's what they would tell you.
Right.
And it was the word. That's why I love organized religion, because they always want you to not laugh. And in the back of the room, we're all going,
really?
You know? And then they break out the rules, and you go, well, why are there these rules? We should try all this stuff. You know what I mean? So that was my problem, you know?
Okay.
If they had used reverse psychology, I wouldn't be here right now.
Dennis, do anything you want. It's cool. It's fine.
I'd be a priest.
One of the things I ended up really liking about your book were the characters of your parents. Not real characters, but real people.
Real people.
I know. Really interesting. And I loved how they encouraged you to be all that you could be within limits.
Well, my parents were Irish immigrants that came from actually adjoining farms in Killarney. And now it's one big farm. But anyways, they came to New York and settled in Worcester, Massachusetts. And at that time, when I was a kid, President Kennedy was the president of the United States. And I went to school one day, and one of the nuns gave a speech about, if you're born in the United States, you can become the president. Anybody can be the president as long as you're born here. So I went home, and I said, Dad, sister, you know, blah, 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 said that, you know, anybody that's born in the United States could be the president. And he said, that's true. And I said, does that mean that I could be the president? And he goes, hell no. What are you? Are you nuts? So it was a major blow to me at the time. And then I realized as I got older that he was trying to explain to me that you could be almost anything.
Almost anything.
But president was a little bit out of reach.
Wow.
So, you know, it was a self-esteem thing that was true, because I couldn't have been the president. First of all, I didn't pay attention in school at all, which didn't help, you know, at all. No. I really I just chopped my own feet off in the presidential race.
Right. So, because the current...
But you wouldn't want me as president. I can love these people who say, you know, I like Sarah Palin because she's so much like us. I don't want somebody like us running the country, okay? All right, I really don't. You know? I think most of us suck, and I'm one of those people that sucks. I want somebody really smart running the country, all right?
Well, Dennis Leary, we're delighted to have you with us. We have invited you here this week to play a game we are calling...
Can you tell me how to get to Sesame Street?
The generation of men and women now running the world were shaped by more than anything the TV show Sesame Street. I'm sure you watched it as a kid.
Or no.
No, you're too old. That's
I'm
the thing.
Too old.
You're too old. That's why you're so bitter and mean, because you didn't have... You haven't read the book. You didn't have the wonderful, charming educational lessons of Sesame Street.
No, I had the Three Stooges.
There you go.
Yeah. Look what happened.
So we're going to ask you three questions about that landmark kids show taken from the new authoritative history of Sesame Street called Street Gang by Michael Davis.
Okay.
Get two of these questions right, you win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl Castle, on their home answering machine, singing his theme song, It's Not Easy Being Avuncular. Carl, who is Dennis Leary playing for?
Dennis is playing for Edith Lees from Omaha, Nebraska.
All right. First question is, I'm sure you remember, or maybe you don't. Sesame Street was known for introducing kids to real-world concepts in a gentle way.
Mm-hmm.
One of the notable early examples was an episode in which one of these things happened. Was it A, Mr. Hooper's grocery store was vandalized? B, folk singer Buffy St. Marie breastfed her baby right in front of Big Bird? Or C, special guest star Elizabeth Taylor explained to Grover why she had had four different husbands? One of them is true.
I'm going to say A.
You're going to say A, Mr. Hooper's grocery store was vandalized?
I'm going with A.
You're going to go with A?
Yeah.
It was Buffy St. Marie.
I can't believe
yeah.
it. Really?
She really was. She was actually she was a guest in the show for the first five seasons, and
really?
They went through her pregnancy and the birth of her baby, off screen, I hope, and her baby's son, whose real name, Dakota Starblanket Wolfchild, eventually got hungry. And so she breastfed him on camera, and Big Bird asked about it, and eventually came to the decision, said, quote, you know, that's nice, said Big Bird.
I can't believe Buffy St. Marie breastfed her.
It's true.
I can't believe Big Bird was okay with it.
Then again, I guess.
Yeah.
His mom was regurgitating food back into his mouth.
Yeah.
Takes all types.
See, breastfeeding looks kind of normal.
Yeah, compared to your mom.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, here's your next question. The show, of course, was for kids, but produced, of course, by adults who off-camera acted like adults. At one of the season rap parties, the puppeteers introduced what new character just for their own entertainment? Was it A, Allie the alcoholic, B, Big Butt, or C, the Nookie Monster?
Oh.
I really got screwed on this quiz.
Yeah.
You should have come on last week. We did Irish Catholicism.
Did you really?
I'm so sorry.
Oh, boy. I'm trying to gauge against the Buffy thing.
The Buffy thing.
Right.
So I got the Alky.
So, you know, it's a rap party. You know what they're like. You're swinging around. They got a puppet.
Well, the rap party makes me think they'd go right to the Nookie Monster.
So, Nookie.
I'm going with Nookie.
You're right. Nookie Monster.
Hey! Not like that.
Well done, sir.
All right.
You can imagine the sort of things that Nookie Monster said at that rap party. All right, it all comes down
to
this.
Do we have a tape of that?
No, yeah. I win.
Okay. So I got one left.
You got one left. You get this one right, you win.
Okay.
All right, last question. Many foreign television companies bought the rights to show the series in their own countries, but the head of children's programming for the BBC back in the late 60s turned it down. Why? Was it because, A, she thought the way the show insisted on right answers to questions was, quote, authoritarian indoctrination? Was it B, she noted that many of the Muppets were naked and therefore immodest? Or C, she felt that it was another attempt to create American cultural dominance of the English-speaking world?
Wow, so, this is really high stakes.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah.
That's it, right.
Yeah. Get this. It's win or go home.
Yeah.
So, okay, I am going to go with the nudity.
You're going to go with the nudity. She's like, the Muppets were naked. She's like, this is... they don't...
Wait. They don't know either.
They have a strong feeling about it. I don't know that they know. I can tell how they
feel. They have a really strong feeling about it.
No, don't throw those things at him.
You guys don't like the immodest idea?
No, they don't like it. They don't like it.
Okay. Let me float another one.
Just spitballing here.
What do you think of the authoritarian...
They like that. They like that. They're very suspicious of authority. Yeah.
Yes?
What would you...
All right. You want C, then. Is that what you want?
All right, I'm going with you. We will sink or swim together. I'm going with C.
I applaud your solidarity, but you're all wrong.
Oh my God!
It was A. It was A.
Oh.
Authoritarian. She thought it was authoritarian the way they answered the questions correctly. You know this, Mom?
No, yes.
You know what? Yeah. Let's boo them until they give us the right answer that we want.
That's awfully authoritarian of you.
I know it really is.
I'm sorry.
Really sorry.
I know we. Hey, at least we're together, right?
Yeah.
We have a bond.
You would have been wrong without them.
Carl, how did Dennis Leary do in our quiz?
Well, Dennis needed two correct answers to win for Edith Lees, but he had just one.
Oh.
I think, wait a minute, let's be honest.
Yeah.
I got one wrong.
Yeah.
And then we all got one wrong.
That's true. Collective guilt, it all went. Dennis Leary is a comedian and the star and co-creator of Rescue Me on the FX Network. He's also the author of the new book, Why We Suck. Dennis Leary, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you.
Give it up for him, ladies and gentlemen. Well done. Thanks, everybody. Now, today, we are revisiting some of the interviews we've done with comedians recently. In November of 2008, we were joined by John Hodgman, who may be, now that James Brown is gone, the hardest working man in show business. He's a correspondent for The Daily Show. He's a best-selling author. He's one of the funniest people around. And, of course, he is the living, breathing, slightly dowdy, anthropomorphized PC in those ubiquitous ads for Apple computers. We asked him what he was told when he first went in to audition for those ads.
Well, they didn't really tell me much of anything.
Right.
But I gather they were looking for someone who was perhaps 37 years old, a little heavier than he used to be, a little wall-eyed. Technically, I'm not wall-eyed. I have a right hyper. My right eye is higher than my left eye. And I think that's what they were looking for.
Now, it is extraordinary to the extent to which you have become ubiquitous everywhere. You cannot not only turn on your TV, but your computer. You keep popping up on my computer in internet ads, which is disconcerting.
Yes. Well, I enjoy watching you while you work.
Thank you. But here is... I'm going to get to this. I turn on my TV. I don't see you. I see a guy that Microsoft has hired who looks like you, who they are putting up as a defense against the implied slander of your ads.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Come on. You must have seen this.
I don't watch television. You know me. It's certainly not ads. I loathe advertising.
I know. But there's a guy at Microsoft who got a job in an ad because he looks like you.
Yes, I've heard tell of such things.
I'm
very happy for him. You know, as somebody who has an accidental television career,
right.
I'm happy to see that happen to somebody else.
I see your
On
point.
Purpose.
That is so one world view.
And you talk about this a bit in your book, how has being a famous minor television personality, as you put it, affected your daily life, John?
Well, you may notice I'm wearing a tuxedo.
That is exciting.
Yes, very nice.
I always dress up for radio. I'm rather surprised to see that you people are not wearing tuxedos.
You know why? These guys dress up to listen at home.
That's right.
That's how fancy they are.
They often come in pajamas, John. Count yourself lucky. But now, because you're a literary guy and author of books, and now you walk around the streets of New York City, and I presume people go nuts to
see you. Yes, I used to enjoy the anonymity of being a literary figure and occasionally a public radio figure.
Yes.
But now people come up to me and they point. Or they will often say, "You look like the guy in those ads."
And what do you say on that occasion?
There's a reason for that. The fact is, I'm very self-similar. I am fractal-like.
Yes, I see.
Thank you, nerds.
Let us talk about the areas of your expertise,
yes,
of which are immense.
That was my old book. That was the old technology.
I'm sorry, but now we moved on to...
The new technology, the upgrade, is entitled More Information Than You Require.
See, here's the thing. Your book, as you confess right up, it's all made up.
It is a book of trivia, much like the old Ripley's Believe It or Not or the Book of Lists, with the advantage that all of the amazing true facts in my book are made up by me.
I wish you had told me that before.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Can't tell you how many bets I've lost.
Well, then I better not tell you how many I've won. You should really stop betting with me on subjects covered in my own book.
You actually have a section on bar bets, actually.
Yes, I do, absolutely. For example, do you know how you? It's called a proposition bet.
Yes.
You go into a bar, and you find someone who's having a drink with their friends, and you interrupt them, and you say, "I bet I can make this match land on its end."
Right.
And then, if they don't hit you, you have a chance to prove it.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the trick. This is what you do. You take the match and you attach a little parachute to it and put some glue on the bottom of it. And you preset that in your jacket.
Right.
And you throw it up in the air, and I would say 2 times out of 10 it works.
I'll have to try that. I was also intrigued and somewhat frightened by your explanation of the tradition of eating oysters.
Oh, yes. Oysters. Well, let me tell you, if you enjoy a food that tastes like snot after it has been rubbed on rocks and old silverware.
Yes.
Then you may enjoy oysters. But do not listen to the killjoys who tell you never to eat oysters in months that do not contain the letter R, May, June, July, August, October, you know. They say that you should not eat oysters during those months because they are the warm months. They are the traditional spawning season of the oyster. And that, of course, is when the oyster tends to beg for its life while you're eating it, which some people find distracting or embarrassing for the oyster. But I say if you're going to eat a creature alive, you have to expect some screaming. That is the, that is the carnivore's burden.
Don't you think? Well, John Hodgman, we are delighted to have you with us. We have asked you here to play a game that this time we're calling...
So you're a PC, huh? We'll see about that.
So you play a PC in
yes,
the commercials.
That is accurate.
But we've been watching them for a while, and we are beginning to suspect you're not really a PC at all. In fact, we think you're
I'm not a computer.
No,
that
no.
Is correct.
We think, in fact, you're a cruel parody of the actual machine as created by its enemies. So we're going to ask you 3 questions about the history of the Microsoft Corporation. Get 2 of these questions right. You'll win our prize for one of our listeners. Carl's voice on their home answering machine.
Damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Exactly. Carl, who is John Hodgman playing for?
John is playing for Ron Blackmore of Madison, New York.
All right.
I'm very sorry, Ron.
All right. First question. In 1976, the young company launched its first print advertisement in a technical journal called Digital Design. What was this advertisement? Was it A picture of the young Bill Gates with his shaggy hair and aviator glasses and the slogan, "He's a stud"? B, a 4-panel comic strip relating, quote, "the legend of the micro kid"? Or C, a densely written description of its proprietary version of the basic computer language written specifically for the Altair personal computer?
I will say C, and here's the reason why.
Please.
Because, you know, I naturally own a lot of very old magazines. And I enjoy going to old magazines because the advertisements in those magazines tended to have thousands of words of copy in them.
They did.
Isn't that strange? For a video game, they would describe it in thousands of words. I mean, they were very wordy at the time. So that's why I'm going to say C.
I love your explanation, but in fact, the
answer was... No one loved my explanation. Don't lie to me.
I'm just trying to make you feel better. The answer was B. It was a 4-panel comic strip.
Oh.
The Adventures of the Micro Kid. He was a boxer, you see. He had speed and power and needed a manager, say a kind of operating system, in order to succeed.
It sounds great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I lost. Sorry about that.
No. You still have 2 more chances.
Oh, okay. Very well.
Once Microsoft got going in the early 80s, it needed a corporate symbol, and it found one. A logo known in the industry as what? A, the blibbit. B, the all-seeing eye. Or C, the exploding head.
The blibbit.
The blibbit?
Yes.
You're right, sir. Ah. The blibbit. The blibbit looked like an O drawn with horizontal lines and lasted a few years. All right, this is very exciting.
This is the tiebreaker?
This is the tiebreaker. You get this right, you win.
I look forward to that.
Microsoft was challenged in its earliest days by another upstart company you might have heard of, Apple.
Microsoft, I hear they're very good.
Yeah, well. Microsoft considered Apple, though, to be evil based on what very real evidence? A, if you typed a certain string of characters into the Apple I computer, it replied, "All hail Satan, all hail Satan."
They call that an Easter egg.
Yes.
B, ironic, isn't it?
B, the original price of the Apple One was $666.66. Or C, the original code name for the project that became the Macintosh, Lucifer.
The answer is B.
The answer is B. The original price was $666.66.
That is my final answer.
You are correct, sir. Very well done. Steve Jobs explained that he thought $666.66 would be an easy number to remember. I have to ask, you were so confident. Is that because as an Apple advertisement to yourself, you are you're up on the history of Apples, or are, did you just happen to know?
I don't wish to brag, but I'm very intelligent. And I did, very luckily, happen to know the answer to that question.
That's amazing. Carl, how did John Hodgman do in our quiz?
Well, John's intelligence was on display here, Peter. He had two correct answers, so he wins for Ron Blackmore.
Well done! A remarkable display of last-minute brilliance.
I'm just glad for Ron Blackmore.
As are we. John Hodgman is a correspondent for The Daily Show. He's the PC on those I'm a Mac and a PC commercials. He is also the author of the excellent, hilariously funny new book, More Information Than You Require. John Hodgman! Thank you so much for joining us.
Amy Sedaris and her brother, writer David Sedaris, used to work together under the name The Talent Family, and the name fits. She's a writer and actress, best known for her TV series, Strangers with Candy, and her book about entertaining called I Like You, Hospitality Under the Influence. When she joined us in December of 2006, along with Charlie Pierce, Mo Rocca, and Amy Dickinson, we started by asking her to explain the title.
Because when you invite someone into your home, be it a dealer or boyfriend, whatever, you're saying, I like you.
Right.
Right, yeah.
Well,
that's why.
I understand.
And Under the Influence is really is about, you know, I was influenced by Girl Scouts and Junior Achievements and my second first grade teacher, you know, all the things that I've been, you know, influenced by. And then I have a whole chapter on how, what a pain in the butt it is to entertain people who do get drunk or really messed up on something, how they can single-handedly bring your party to a screaming halt. Because they always think of the life of the party, but really they bring it down.
Now, I noticed, I was leafing through the book, and I noticed it has many recipes.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And
lots of pictures and large print.
Oh, yeah, lots of pictures and large print. I'm sure you
did. I really kept the illiterate in mind because a lot of people who can't read, that's one thing, and then there are a lot of people who just don't know how to read. So I wanted to do a visual book so that when they saw the picture, it would inspire them to write their own story in their head.
Right. Do you advise? I mean, are these real recipes? If I make these recipes?
Yeah, I took it seriously. A lot of the humor came from Paul Dinello making fun of the fact that I was trying to be serious. So I decided to make it a little bit more entertaining than I originally wanted to. Because I just don't like joke cookbooks. And it would just go into a wacky pile and nobody would take it seriously. So it's all real.
Including, like, your list of munchies?
Munchies! Yeah, that was a hard list to come up with.
Yeah, I could tell.
Someone thought I was holding a hummingbird feeder in that picture, and it's a bong, and it's so funny to me. I'm like, why would I be holding a hummingbird feeder looking like that? That's so funny to me.
I mean, the list starts out okay.
That could explain why the hummingbirds fly upside down and backwards in my yard.
Yeah.
I thought it was a hummingbird feeder when I found it in the garage.
Well, they got some good chronic. That's what it is.
Forgotten I own that.
Well, Amy Sedaris, we are delighted to have you with us. We have asked you here to play a game we're calling...
Drinking This Much will either win me a Pulitzer Prize or make not winning a lot easier to take.
Not all great writers are drinkers, but certainly it often seems that way. We recently came across a book called Hemingway and Bailey's Bartending Guide.
Wow.
It's a book of anecdotes and cocktail recipes from the country's famous authors. We'll ask you three questions about the drinking habits of literary geniuses in history.
Okay.
Get two questions right, you will win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice on their home answering machine.
Wow, okay.
Okay, so Carl, who is Amy Sedaris playing for?
Amy is playing for David Tuttle of Arcata, California.
Okay.
All right, ready?
Yes.
Here we go. Here's your first question. There are big drinkers, and then there's Jack Kerouac. The author of On the Road once got so drunk he did what? A, he roasted, cut up, and ate a Goodyear truck tire. B, he enlisted in the Navy, Coast Guard, and Marines on the same day. Or C, he got married to a 47-year-old elevator operator who spoke no English.
Oh, they're all so good. Sophie's Choice. I'm going to say 3.
You're going to say he got married to that 47-year-old elevator operator who spoke no English.
It's not true. I'm going to say 3, but I bet it's 2.
Ooh. Well, what are you going to say? I want you to.
I am saying 3, but I bet it's 2.
I don't know what this says about you. It is the second choice. It's B.
Yeah, it
yes.
is. Yeah.
It was the Navy, Coast Guard, and Marines.
I knew it.
So why didn't you?
Because that's what I would do. I would get on a line. You know, when you're like that, and you just call everybody. But I don't know. I like the idea of 3, but I knew it was 2.
All right. Yeah, he did. He enlisted on the same day into the Navy, Coast Guard, and Marines. Strangely, by the time he sobered up, he was on board a ship headed for Greenland. He was in the Merchant Marine. Mm.
So I know I lost it, but
No. You have 2 more chances if you get the next 2 right.
It was a choice to lose.
If you get 2 more right, you will win. So don't lose hope. Here we go. Author Sherwood Anderson died from drinking, not in the way, though, you might
think. That's hilarious. Go on.
But he did not die in the way you might think. What finally did him in? Was it A, he realized his newly bought bottle of scotch was Johnny Walker Red, not black. He turned around to go return it and was hit by a truck. B, he was talking and drinking and eating at a shipboard cocktail party and he swallowed a toothpick. Or C, he suggested to a sailor that drinking creme de menthe was, quote, sort of a namby-pamby thing to do, is it not, unquote.
It was two.
The toothpick?
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
That's what happened.
I was going to say toothpick of our campaign, but...
Wow.
Yeah.
Toothpick is very dangerous. I know that.
Yeah, and he
died. That and campaign buttons.
Have you swallowed a campaign button?
No, not yet.
Okay, you've gotten one right. You've gotten one right. Well, anyway, that is how Sherwood Anderson died. He swallowed a toothpick, it gave him peritonitis, and he passed away. It's true. If you get this last question correct, Amy, you will, in fact, win. Here we go.
Wow, I never win anything.
Well, you might win this. Last question. Thomas Wolfe, the author, of course, of You Can't Go Home Again, Look Homeward, Angel. He could be alarming as a drinking buddy. Why? A, he liked to bite off parts of his glass and chew on them. B, when he ran out of liquor in the middle of the night, he would break into friends' homes and drink theirs. Or C, he liked to challenge people to a drinking game called I Can Down Any Bottle of Any Booze in 60 Seconds.
He sounds like a terrible guest.
Is he saying anybody? I know he's dead. Let's see. Gosh, okay, chewing the glass, which, okay, that's a possibility. I'm going to say 3.
You're going to go with C, that choice.
It's not C. I can tell by your disappointed in my choice.
No, I was just trying to build up some dramatic tension. I wasn't trying to indicate
one. Well, you're
one
doing a good job. All now right. I'm depressed.
But that is your choice, C.
Yeah, but I bet it's 1. What is it?
Yes, it was 1, I'm afraid. Yes.
You know why I thought it was 1? Because my brother David had this Ronco glass cutter, and he would take our wine bottles and make them into glasses, but he would never sand the edges, so when we would drink from the glass, we would all cut our lips. Oh. And that's why I thought it was believable. But damn it, I picked C.
Yeah, you did. Jeez. And he did like, Thomas Wolfe apparently did like to chew glass. We don't know why.
Wow.
But he did.
Well, I guess I'm a loser.
Well, let's find out. Carl, how did Amy Sedaris do in our quiz?
Well, she said it. To make it official, Amy needed 2 correct answers at least to win. She had just 1 correct answer.
I know. We all know. Why repeat it? Now I'm depressed.
All right. Amy Sedaris is a comedian, actress, and author of the new book, I Like You, Hospitality Under the Influence. Amy Sedaris, thank you so much
for
joining
us. Thank you so much, you guys.
Thank you so much. This week we are revisiting some of our visits with people who have an odd job, convincing you, by any means possible, to make reflexive vocalizations indicating amusement. And they're not allowed to tickle you.
Drew Carey was a stand-up before starring in his own hit sitcom, The Drew Carey Show. Then once he was a star and could do anything he wanted to do, he decided to become, of all things, a game show host.
Imagine that.
When he joined us along with Luke Burbank, Paula Poundstone, and Mo Rockup in February of 2008, we asked him why.
Because I love giving away other people's money.
Yeah.
It's the greatest thing. I'm telling you, I think like everything in my life led me to be the host of The Price is Right, because it's full of regular people. They just stand in line and they get on the show. I get to give away cash. People are real excited. It's a studio just full of love and happiness and joy. I love being in that environment. I couldn't have picked a better job, honestly.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah.
Do you ever feel weird when it's like a college student and you reveal the prize and it's like a huge chandelier and a mahogany china closet?
All the time. It's always like a lovely grandfather clock, and you also get supplements.
Yeah.
That'll go awesome in the frat.
Yeah, every college kid needs garlic.
Drew, you took over, of course, in one of the great legends of entertainment, the silver-haired Bob Barker himself.
Uh-huh.
Was that intimidating?
No, because he gave me his blessing.
Really? Was there like a transfer of power, a coronation? Did he knight you with the wand-like microphone?
Oh, you didn't see the special on CNN?
No.
It was like the Pope. There was smoke that came from a chimney.
Yeah, exactly.
Successful. We have selected a host.
The CBS executives, they all met in Rome.
Yeah.
He did it on an interview, and I told CBS, I said, I'd only do it if Bob, you know, said it was cool. And then Bob, that was his exact quote. He says, it's cool with me.
What's your favorite game?
I like spinning the wheel, actually. And I like the yodely guy game where he falls off the cliff.
Mountain climber?
Mountain climbers. Yeah. But everybody, all my friends call it the yodely guy game. And the reason I like it is because, you know, the farther off you are, I'm guessing the price of something, the higher up the guy goes up the mountain. And at the end, if you're too much, he goes off the edge of the mountain and dies.
A grisly death.
Yeah. Really grisly death. And he has this little smile on his face, and they play this really happy yodely music, and he's just marching up the mountain. He doesn't know what's happening.
He's like one of the Von Trapps going over the Alps.
Yeah, he's going for a walk, and then he just goes off the side of the cliff.
We have on this show, specifically Paula has on this show, made some comments about Cleveland. Our listeners in Cleveland were not... You don't even remember this, Paula, but...
No, I don't.
It's a show we did in Berkeley. We've rebroadcast it a couple times, and you make these jokes about Cleveland. And so since we've got you, Cleveland's most famous native son, if you will, I was wondering, could you tell us right now some great things about Cleveland? Why Cleveland rocks, if you will.
Oh, the reason I like Cleveland so much is it's like... you know what it is? It's like a little mini Chicago. Everything you would like about Chicago is in Cleveland. But Cleveland, to me, is a more manageable size. You can get from one side of the town to the other in like 20 minutes.
Does it have a tram, like a nice sort of transportation system?
The bus system is really good in Cleveland. As a matter of fact, I used to take the bus all the time when I was growing up.
And crosstown and uptown and downtown.
Yeah, exactly. That's what you say. You say to the friendly guy on the bus, you say, take me uptown, and he takes you right there.
That's great.
He doesn't have
He gives you a tip of the hat. Yeah. He rubs your hair.
Drew, he doesn't have a predetermined route?
Do you get back there a lot, Drew?
I don't get back as often as I'd like to, but, you know,
often exactly do you get back there?
As long as the buses are running.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You get on an airplane and you say, take me to Cleveland.
To Uptown.
Hey, as long as if you're going to New York, why don't you drop me off in Cleveland? I'm
Well, Drew Carey, we have asked you here to play a game we're calling...
You're the very nicest person ever to appear on television.
We're not referring to you, of course.
I know.
It was 40 years ago this week that an ordained Presbyterian minister named Fred Rogers stepped in front of a TV camera to put on a red cardigan for the first time. In honor of the late, great Mr. Rogers, we're going to ask you three questions about him. It's taken from a list put together by Mental Floss magazine.
Oh, man.
Get two right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl Castle's voice in their home answering machine.
All right.
And maybe you'll learn a little something for use in your own show.
All right.
Corva, who is Drew Carey playing for?
Ellen Nixon in Houston, Texas.
First question about Mr. Rogers.
All right.
He was hugely popular, of course, among multiple generations of children. Mm-hmm. And their children when they grew up. But he had one rather surprising but very enthusiastic fan. Who was it? A, North Korean dictator Kim Jong-il. B, Coco the talking gorilla. Or C, Scientology founder L. Ron Hubbard.
You know, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say Kim Jong-il.
No, it was Coco the gorilla. That was the famous gorilla. Yeah, wow. That was the famous gorilla that learned to use American Sign Language to communicate. She was also a very big fan of Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. And when Fred visited her in California, she gave him a big hug and then immediately bent down and took off his shoes.
Really?
Wow.
Now, you still have two more chances here.
All right.
Here we go.
Mr. Rogers not only entertained and comforted generations of children, he had a profound effect on the history of the entertainment industry. How? Was it A, wanting the audience's viewpoint to be more like that of an active child, he invented the modern television camera dolly? B, he almost single-handedly saved the VCR by convincing the Supreme Court that taping his shows would be fine with him? Or C, not wanting to scare children, he developed the natural-looking TV makeup still used today?
Thank Pornography you. Saved the VCR. I don't believe the third one. I'd say A.
You're going to go for A, that he invented the modern camera dolly so it could move around?
Ooh, that feels right.
It feels right, Mo?
No, he didn't invent the camera dolly, because the camera dolly was invented for movies. It's probably the VCR.
Is that your choice?
Yeah, B.
You're right. Very good. You figured it out. That's exactly what happened.
Oh, my gosh.
In the 70s, the movie studios sued the makers of video recorders. They said their machines would infringe on their patent by recording their material. But Fred Rogers testified that taping his show would allow parents to watch it with their kids. He conceived of time shifting, you see.
Right.
And thus he thought VCRs would be a good thing. The Supreme Court cited his testimony in their seminal decision, Sony versus Universal, which made VCRs legal. So it was Fred Rogers and porn.
Yeah.
That saved the
winning
VCR.
Combination.
Yeah. Last question. By the end of his career, Mr. Rogers was a universally beloved figure, especially in his hometown of Pittsburgh, as evidenced by what incident? A, when Premonti Brothers, the famous Pittsburgh sandwich shop, made fun of him with a, quote, Mr. Rogers bland sandwich. They had not a single customer walk into their store until they apologized.
Wow.
Was it B, people would line up on the deck of the pool where he swam every morning just to applaud him when he finished? Or C, when the local news reported his car had been stolen, it was returned the next day with a note reading, quote, if we'd known it was yours, we never would have taken it.
Oh, Jesus, they're all so heartwarming. I want them all to be right.
Yeah.
It's not B. People didn't line up to watch him swim. I doubt that they would ever invent a bland sandwich and that nobody would walk in there.
Right.
See, people walk in there. Sorry. People walk into that place no matter what. They walk in there when they're drunk. They're not going to care about Mr. Rogers. So I'll say it was C.
You're going to go with C, that they gave him his car back?
Yeah.
You're right. Oh. Very good. That's what happened.
Yay. So happy everyone.
That is impressive deduction.
I'm
right,
really
Gary.
Impressed about your knowledge of drunk dining at Premonti Brothers, because you're absolutely right about that.
Instead of getting low-jacked, I'm going to put a sign on my car that says, this car belongs to Mr. Rogers.
Yes, very smart. Yeah.
Korva, how did Drew Carey do in our quiz?
Well, Peter, Drew got 2 out of 3 correct, and so he's 1 for Ellen Nixon.
Congratulations.
Hey,
well done.
I'm so nervous about losing on the show, I can't tell you.
No, man, you pulled it off. It was great. Drew Carey is the host of The Price is Right. You can also see him on The Power of 10 and Whose Line Is It Anyway? Drew Carey, thank you so much for joining us.
My
what
pleasure.
A pleasure to have you.
It's a real honor. Thank you.
Oh, it was an honor to have you. Bye-bye, Drew.
Bye.
Comedian Julia Sweeney has made a career of late of being very funny about not very funny things, like, say, her bout with cancer and her subsequent loss of faith. This from a woman who first became famous playing the weirdly asexual character Pat on Saturday Night Live.
When she joined us in April of 2007 with panelists Roy Blunt Jr., Roxanne Roberts, and Luke Burbank, she expressed some unhappiness at where her career had taken her.
I cancer? Hate that about my career. Oh, I want to do easier topics and apply, you know. I don't know. I feel like I was Pat, and then I became cancer woman, and now I'm atheist woman.
Wow.
It's horrifying. I don't, how could I be?
Yes, I mean, like what Foster Brooks was to drunkenness, you are to mortal disease and the meaning and the lack of meaning of existence.
It's, yes.
Do a giant red squirrel every now and then.
No.
Let's go back to your monologues for a second. So it's interesting. I want to talk about In God... Letting Go of God, your monologue about your wonderful, hilarious, fun-filled journey toward atheism and lack of faith. But isn't it true? I mean, we read that when you were a kid, you fantasized about being a nun.
Oh, yes. I enjoyed being raised Catholic. I'm, you know, the Catholic Church, that was like opera to me. It was like theater. You know, you go and people wear outfits and they have lines and there's all kinds of incense and singing. I loved it.
Really?
Yeah. No, but I wanted to be a nun, and I even went and Sister Antonella, one of the sisters at Marycliffe, where I went to an all-girls Catholic high school, sent me off to a convent for a weekend, and I hung out with the nuns for the weekend to see if I wanted to be a nun.
What'd you think?
I did not like it because they were too liberal for me at
no,
the time.
Really?
Oh, yes. I wanted a habit, and I wanted to, you know, wear a hair shirt and stuff like that. But they just wore, like, jeans and plaid shirts and played kumbaya and, like, did good works for
they
the
were
poor.
They were those singing nuns, weren't
yes,
they?
Yes, I didn't want that. I wanted to be, like, you know, in a nun story. I wanted, right. you know, my hair to get cut off and wear the severe outfit.
You wanted to be Maria before they kicked her out?
Yes.
Yes.
The incorrigible one, the one who's curious but stays in.
Do you feel guilty now making your living in part by going around and proclaiming your atheism?
I mean, I do because I hate... First of all, I don't like that word atheist, but I have to accept it, I guess. Because
yeah.
I, in fact, don't believe... I don't live my life under the assumption there's a God. Therefore, I'm an atheist, you know, non-theist. But I just... I mean, I have the same association with that word that I think most people in our culture growing up here does, which, you know, is like communist dictator
right.
or something.
Why don't you go with infidel?
Yeah. I know. I like infidel. Yeah. I like free thinker.
Free thinker. That's good.
See, I like that.
Yeah.
There you go.
In fact, that reminds me that... I was doing my show, and then I did a benefit in Spokane, Washington, where I'm from, for the Catholic Charities. And they put, like, I was doing these shows.
Wait a minute. You're doing your show about being an atheist as a benefit for the Catholic Charities?
No, I didn't do the show.
Okay,
for them.
I was like, that would be great.
No, I just went and hosted an auction.
Okay.
For them. And they didn't want to put, so they said, well, what's your latest show about? Because they put, you know, God said, ha. And then I said, well, my latest show is all about how I went from being a Catholic to just not really believing in God. And then they didn't want to put atheists in the program. So they put, it chronicles my journey from religious faith to philosophical naturalism. And several nuns came up to me and said, oh, that show sounds fantastic.
You know, the guy goes in the bar and says, he has a quick drink and said, are there any penguins this high? Said, no. I don't know. How about this high? Are there penguins that high? No. One more drink. How about, I mean, just like maybe a penguin about like that high? And they say, no. And he said, oh, God, I ran over a nun. That's a little...
Well,
no. See, I could feel. You know, I want to defend nuns for that joke.
Yeah,
yeah. Because you want to rise to their defense.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. No more nun jokes, Roy.
Come on,
take that anti-nun humor elsewhere, please.
I was sent here to get you back to the church, and that's why.
And this was your way.
Yeah. That's
okay.
I gotta say, since you are a philosophical naturalist,
yes.
you'll have no one to call upon as you play our game. Which today, we are calling...
Don't call me a carny, you mooch. I'm a showman.
So next time you're at a carnival or sideshow, stop and listen to the people working the rides and games, but do not call them carnies. They do not like that. That's something we now know because we read a book called Talk the Talk, a dictionary of slang. Answer two questions correctly about the way carnival workers talk... And you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice in the home answering machine.
Okay.
So you ready to do this?
I'm ready.
Okay. You seem confident. I like that about
well,
you.
Well, I feel relaxed in the fact that this is not my job.
There you are. We lower the expectations right
okay,
out.
Okay, excellent.
Yes. Carl, who is Julia Sweeney playing for?
Julia is playing for Karen Reeker of Jacksonville, Florida.
All right, first question. How do the carnival workers refer to the sword swallower down in the sideshow? A, they call that person the steel nosher. B, the blade glommer. Or C, the silverware snacker.
I would say B, the blade glommer.
The blade glommer? You are correct. Very good.
Wow.
The blade glommer, that's what they call the sword swallower. I don't know why.
Because that's easier than sword swallower?
I know. Next question. They have a lot of interesting names for, well, us. Which of these is a term used for people who come to the carnival just to look but not to spend any money on the games? A, leisure suit leeches. B, lot lice. Or C, smart people.
I would say lot lice.
Lot lice?
Yes.
Once again, you're correct, my God.
Have you worked at a carnival? I'm beginning to wonder here.
Oh, Peter, I have. I have. I have a side job.
You really?
No.
You're a sideshow attraction. Come see the atheist wannabe nun. All right, this is amazing. I want to see if you can go for three here. Last question. Sometimes carnival people need more than just a few slang words to hide their deliberations and plans from the customers in front of them. So if some of them use, what clever communication system? A, they use their ever-present cigarettes to blow smoke signals. B, they have worked out a code language based entirely on obscenities, so that a certain sequence of obscenities will mean something. Or C, they have their own language called Kiazarn, which is just adding the sound ias to the middle of every word.
Wow, that's hard. I would say C.
You're going to go for Kiazarn?
I'm going to use Kiazarn. No.
You're right.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, I'm so happy.
Kiazarn is the language of the carnies. So if one carny wanted to tell another about a mark coming down the midway, he'd say, and let me see if I can do this because I'm not fluent. Liazuk. Miazuk, Kiazuming, Diazound, Miazidway. And thus we remain in the dark about their evil plans.
Wow, that's
amazing.
Interesting. Yeah.
Carl, how did Julia Sweeney do in our quiz?
Wow, perfect, Peter. She had three correct answers. So, Julia, you win for Karen Reeker.
Wow, I'm so happy.
That's great.
That's great. Thank you.
Julia Sweeney is an actress, comedian, and author of the new book, Letting Go of God. It's also available on CD at juliasweeney.com. Go there, find out everything. Julia Sweeney, thank you so much for being with us. Julia Sweeney, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from CSX, whose trains can move a ton of freight, 423 miles on 1 gallon of fuel. CSX, how tomorrow moves. The National Association of Realtors, whose members recognize that every market is different. A realtor is a member of the National Association of Realtors. And to the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. On the web at fordfound.org. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and Chicago Public Radio. In association with Urgent Haircut Productions, Doug Berman, executive producer. BJ Liederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Emily Ecton. Our technical directors are Robert Newhouse and Lorna White. The senior producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Mike Danforth. Thanks to Carl Castle. Thanks to all of our panelists and all of our wonderful guests. And thanks to all of you for listening. I am Peter Sagal. We will be back with you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.